Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Hey, hello, everyone. This is Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. And I guess we only got 2 more weeks. Ooh. For what was it? The 21, the special date. Will be interesting things. Anyway, just a suggestion for those out there. And in fact, I was just briefly speaking of it with my esteemed producer. For those out there, I would highly suggest during the 21st, even though my show airs on too, to not have your computer connected to your wall circuits and also your cell phones and chargers, due to the fact that we'll more than likely have some very interesting solar flares. Not that this will protect it, it just one aspect, but it will cause electromagnetic flares, which will affect our internet, which will affect a lot of weird stuff happening during that day, possibly happening. Again, possibly, not for sure. Anyway, I want to thank you all for listening again, and on another glorious, glorious day. Also, those who celebrate Hanukkah, I'm always the first light, so happy Hanukkah or Hatzimah. Now, I know in recent events, I mean, there's a plethora of stuff around the world, blah, 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 blah. And I know over the Middle East, and there's Syria, and the UN, and Egypt, and you, like, got bombarded, and people, and, you know, we have, everybody has their daily lives to do their things, blah, 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 things, you know. But I think in relations to that areas which directly affect us, both directly economically, you can think about why certain things occur, which I won't get into much. And I did that sort of in passing last week of talking about energy. For example, Iranians actually wanted Hamas. If things started happening, why? To increase rates of oil, therefore they get more money for their oil. This is also what's also influenced by causing more turmoil in the Middle East, thus manipulating oil prices to some degree, acutely. Anyway. Now, when I look at the Middle East in whole, what it was, what it is, and what it is now, most people generally, when they first think of the Middle East, they think of the Israelis and the Palestinians. Then they may think of Syria, and of course in Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, Iran, and maybe even Saudi Arabia. For now, I'm going to get into the discussions primarily focusing on the Israeli, Palestinian, Syrians, Jordan, even Lebanon, Iraq, Egypt, Iran, all that stuff, pretty much in case, which I'll have, and I'll break it up for you. But first, I think it's imperative to have a greater understanding of Egypt and getting with the dynamics of Egypt, especially what's going on now with Morsi, who is head of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's the president of Egypt, and what's really going on and whatever the dynamics. And of course, he's trying to push for an edict where he basically dictates into certain areas. So much for democracy there. But first, somebody, you know, before I get into that, I want to explain something of the Muslim Brotherhood, because I think people don't understand the history of what it is and how it occurred and implications in Egypt. And it's primarily, it's so fundamental of why the dynamics happened in Egypt and the links between various factions that even spread throughout the Middle East and areas up forth. In the 1920s, that was when the Hashemites were kicked out, or King Hejaz was kicked out of Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis took over, and that was convincing. There was all enormous reserves of oil discovered by British petroleum products, and that all later became Aramco, It became a center of establishment. Thus, things had changed quite overnight. And there was a development of what is known as the Wahhabi, which is a form of, I would say, Islamic beliefs. And if I would get into Wahhabism, it is a radical form of Islam founded by Muhammad ibn, Abdul al-Wahhab in the 18th century, who claims that any teaching added to Islam after the 10th century are false. It envisions an Islamic empire led by only holy men, with no other law than Puritan Islamic law. This is why they refer to the Islamic fundamentals. It opposes the concept of nationalism or borders as being un-Islamic. It justifies violent means to rid the Muslim world against non-Islamic elements. Wahhabism eventually developed a very strong anti-American, anti-Western message. It is generally rejected by vast majority of in the Muslim world, generally. In the 1920s, it became its development. The Wahhaba and Wahhaba religious police operated and ruled power of terror within the Saudi towns or Arabian towns, and churches and synagogues and non-Arab were banned or simply destroyed. The Wahhabi movement grows and grows and increasingly radicalized within the Arabia Peninsula, primarily after the fall of the Hashemites, who were kicked out. Eventually, the Saudi family took over, thus became the Wahhabi. In 1927, the extremists revolt against Saudi regime became of increasing dealings and rebellion, but they were soon crushed. In fact, these extremists, the Wahhabi, relocated to Egypt. Thus, thoughts of the jihad against the Western Americans became central to its movement. Get it? The Saudis became very allied with the British. And because they are kicked out of Saudi Arabia, now Saudi Arabia, they became their biggest enemy is the U.S. and the Brits. So the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt becomes the home of the Wahhabi extremism. In fact, in 1928, Muslim Brotherhood was established in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna. And then the Mother's Organization for today's Egypt became Jihad Islamic and Hamas. The Brotherhood is built on the Wahhab foundations. In 1928, Amin al-Hussein becomes a prominent member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Remember that name. He became the infamous leader of the Palestinians. He sees the Wahhab concept of Islamic Jihad as a tool to rally pan-Islamic support, the furthest gen of a pan-Islamic takeover. The Muslim Brotherhood, now under Hussein's influence, becomes the main vector of hate against the West and the Jews. The Arab world, which includes Palestine, must be free of any non-Islamic elements or even faith. Therefore, Jews and Christians have no claim to any part of the Mideast or of the Arab world. In 1933, Hitler rises to power. After the humiliation of World War I, Germany votes overwhelmingly for Hitler, of course. And then Hitler and Muslim find common ground. Hitler's vision of ethnic cleansing of Aryans becomes appealing to the Wahhabis of the Muslims. The West and the Jews is a common enemy. Muslim Brother acquires Hitler's methods of genocide to rid the Arab of its non-Muslims. Now, al-Hussein, which I'll get into, was part of that, going back during the time of the Ottomans, getting rid of the Christian Armenians. Anyway, in 1933, the Nazis appear throughout the Arab world. A young Egypt, led by a Muslim Brotherhood member, Abdul Gamal Nasser, future Egyptian president, Young Egypt's slogan was "One folk, one party, one leader." Is direct translation from the Nazis' own German slogan. In fact, the Socialist Nazi Party in Syria was led by Etan Saadat, known as the Syrian Führer. In 1939-45, Husseini calls the Nazi Muslim troops cream of Islam. In fact, Al-Mahamin spends his debut during World War II in Germany at Hitler's side. He establishes Muslim SS troops, which becomes heavily involved in the genocide of Jews, Gypsies, and Serbs. So, in fact, the Palestinian Arab was involved with the genocide with Jews. They did not have hands clean as they claim. Amin Hussein is one of the primary founders and inspiration of our Arab League. Goal is to reinforce Wahhabi vision of a pan-Islamic unity. Founding countries are Egypt, Iran, Jordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen. Hussein, still in Egypt, is appointed to the president in absentia of the Fourth Higher Committee of the Arab League. He becomes the co-founder and president of the Arab League. Now you know how the Arab League was found. It was associated originally with the Muslim Brotherhood. In 1945, Amin al-Hussein was the leader of Muslim Brotherhood. From the mid-1940s, al-Hussein is appointed leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Jerusalem. He becomes number one active supporter of Nazi mythology to the Middle East. In fact, Husseini later flees to Egypt as he was wanted by Yugoslavia for war crimes against humanity that he perpetrated during World War II. From 1949 to 1952, the Adasa network spread. That was when Egypt, home of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Syria incorporated thousands of Nazi experts into its own Egyptian and Syria army and government. A propaganda service. Vatican heavily involved in Iran travel visas for these Nazi officers. Amin al-Hussein provided a safe haven to ex-Nazis in Arab lands. He is the main connection with François Genod, the Swiss banker of the Third Reich, who finances the Odessa Project, which was stolen money from murdered European Jews. After World War II, Nil Hussein was visited numerous times in Beirut by Hitler's Swiss bank, as I had mentioned. In 1947, which goes into the Palestinian Mandate, which I'm going to get into later. In 1948, Yasser Arafat, Egyptian-born Yasser Arafat, becomes a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He works directly under al-Amin Husseini since the age of 17. Arafat is placed in charge of the terror group known as the Holy Strugglers, responsible for disrupting peace in the Middle East. When the Arab League declares wars against the Jewish state in 1948, Husseini, who was the president of the Arab League, said, I quote, "I declare a holy war. My Muslim brothers murder the Jews." Now, the Muslim Brotherhood did branch off and created Hamas in 1987. Spiritual founder Wahhabi Sheikh Ahmed Yasin. Yasser is actually financed originally by Saudi oil. From 1987 to 1983, during the first Empedias against Israel, 2,400 Palestinians are killed. 800 are killed by Yasin's Arafat Fatah group, being traitors or informants. Infidia financed by oil. during the second Invadada from 2000 to 2002, became the second Palestinian Fidea, led by Yasser Arafat's various groups of Fatah, Tazim, Al-Qazab Brigade, and Force 17. Going back to Egypt, it was developed. In 1952, Egypt developed the Bastonian Rahibim, a Muslim Brotherhood. It is well known that al-Hussein was very tight with Abdel Nasser, who later became president of Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood and Young Egypt, the Nazi Party, overthrew the British mandate in Egypt and put Gamal Nasser in power. The mentor by their Nazi colleagues, total dictatorship installed, imposed, all parties are abolished. Nasser repatriates and works closely with thousands of Nazis imported. Nasser, in 1955, formed the Fatahian terrorist groups. Nasser, now president of Egypt, creates the Fatahian Arab terrorist groups to infiltrate and attack relentlessly Israel. He will later merge with Yasser Arafat to form the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was spun off of the Muslim Brotherhood, but was organized and developed in the framework of the Soviet Union. In 1952 to 1970, Egyptian economy crumbles under Nasser's dream. Nasser's socialist reforms fail, and Muslim Brotherhood turns against Nasser because of his attempts to reform Egyptian society. Nasser then turns around in 1954, outlaws the Brotherhood. From 1970 to 1981, Muhammad al-Hassad becomes Egyptian president, and he rebuilds the economy with a strong focus on tourism. Egypt becomes a leading Arab nation once again. Open door policy and freedom of expression is perceived as a threat by Muslim Brotherhood. In 1978, Sadat recognizes the statehood of Israel and leads to the Camp David Accords. This draws the wrath of the Muslim Brotherhood, of which he had been a member of. Sadat receives the International Nobel Peace Prize, of course. In 1978, the first offspring of Muslim Brotherhood, as mentioned, was Jihad Islam Group, founded in Egypt in response to Camp David, and more radical and more violent than the Muslim Brotherhood. They were led by Dr. Ayman al-Sawari, student and protege of Hassan Tarab, and spiritually Wahhabi Sheikh Umar Aman, and their goal of their group was to restore Islamic Wahhabi dictatorship in Egypt. In 1979, the Arab League suspended Egypt. Egypt's government of Sadat was suspended by the Arab League due to the Camp David Accords from 1979 to 1989. From 1981, the Muslim Brotherhood assassinates Anwar Sadat through the vehicle of the Jihad Islami, because he had indeed signed with the peace agreement with Israel. From 1981 to very recently, the Hussein Mubarak, Sadat's vice president, becomes the Egyptian president. He declares a war on the Muslim Brotherhood and severely damages the Brotherhood's infrastructures. From 1995 to 2002, Islamic Jihad attempts to assassinate Mubarak, but the attempt was failed. To this day, the Muslim Brotherhood was trying to destabilize Egypt's secular government and replace it with Islamic dictatorships. Thus, you have Egypt. And when they had the elections, when people got influence out of their elections, the Brotherhood became empowered. And what is their democracy? Democracy is probably the worst kind of government you can ever have. One of the worst. Simply put, a regular democracy is mob rule. what needs to be, would have been a democratic republic. As Benjamin Franklin said about democracy, it's like two wolves and one sheep deciding what's for supper. This is what you have in Egypt today. You have a small majority dictating to the minority without any real rights for the minority. There's no protection. That's the most important thing for a democracy to be held. You must have a Bill of Rights, a protection for the minority. And most important, freedom to expression, which I will get into next week over blasphemy and free thought, which people around the world do have issues with, which they do not understand about America, but that is the fundamental freedom of expression, which I will not get into today. So you have the certain stuff in Egypt, and look what's going on. All Egypt is they change from one dictator to the next. Before there was Nasser, they had King Farhad, who was allied to the British. And when he fell, of course, the Muslim put in Nasser, and he was allied with the Soviet Union. Same enemy, anti-West. So when Egypt lost its wars to Israel and finally Sadat came over, it was through the vehicle of Kissinger, which I'll get into, who wedged the Soviet influence and changed the dynamics in the Middle East and making finally Egypt and Israel bringing in peace. It was not Carter. It was already in the works, but I'll get to that. Anyway, that is the true dynamics of Egypt. That is why we have what it is now. Egypt's basically a screwed up country. It's poor. They're always starving. They're the second largest, after Israel, the second largest country that receives, and not far off from Israel, receives the amount of financial benefits. It has the largest army of all Arab states. Yet it's extremely poor. That is the dilemma in Egypt. And right now it's run by the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not an easy, fun-loving people. Group. Their sole purpose has no boundaries. It's not that there's Egypt or not that there's a Saudi Arabia or Jordan. Their belief is there's no borders. It would be under one Islamic caliph, like one Muhammad running the entire area from Morocco all to Indonesia. That is their belief. It is fundamentally the same as Nazi Germany. This is what even Hamas, its charter believes. It has nothing to do about Israel, about land or anything. It has to remove the physical elements of Jews and Christians. It being a Jewish state, it means to be there. This is why they call it an entity. This is why they're against Christians in Lebanon. This is why they hate Americans. It has nothing to do about Israel. It is about anything other than Muslim. Their form of Muslim, which is Sunni Muslim. This goes now to Syria, Iran, Lebanon. What is happening today in Syria is the epitome of Sunni versus Shiite war. I mean, it goes back based upon the Shiite war was based upon originally for thousands of years. It comes from not thousands, but hundreds of years. It started, even though it's sort of retarded, it's like fighting over my God's better than your God and crap, which is all over everywhere, right? But it all started after Muhammad's death. And who would be the caliph, the leader of all Muslims? Ali was his descendant to be caliph. And that is who the Shiite looked at to be the caliph. But it was the Sunnis who believed that Abu Bakr, the father of Muhammad's wife, Aisha, was a rightful successor, and he became the successor. And there was two others that came, and then finally Ali became finally, and then Ali was killed, and that was where the start of it. But that was just part of it. And then there was another change that happened. Later on in the 1500s, a new kind of sort of situation arose. A new Shiite belief, which Al-Alat looked at to themselves in the belief of Ali being the real leader. But they also looked at a different view of Islam. It would be like Catholics versus Protestants. You can look at the Shiites being more Catholic and the Sunnis more Protestants to some extent. It's not exactly, but it's based upon more political power than religious differences. Like I just told you, it's about control of the Middle East. And the Brotherhood, by the way, are Sunni-based. They're Wahhab. So even though Hamas might be allied with getting money from Iran, in fact, they're Brotherhood-based. If it came down to there was no, God forbid, no Israel, and it was only Shiites and Sunnis, they would fall directly in war with Iran. This is what's going on right now in Syria. Now, if you go back to the 1500s, and Ismail, king of Iran, initiated a religious policy which he recognized Shiism as official religion of the Safavid Empire. In fact, that became the edict where modern Iran remains, officially a Shiite state. And it was all directed by Ismail's actions. And then he later, Ismail I, in the 1500s, tried to spread his Shiite Islam to Ottoman Empire. And this led to the major battles, one of which was known as the Battle of Shadrin. And this gap continued well through the 20th century. Even today, we see it in Iraq. We'll see it in Jordan. We'll see it in Syria. We'll see it in Lebanon. It is a crescent that Khomeini started. People said, well, Iraq started the war against Iran. No. It was really fundamentally, even though Khomeini was initiating the spread of Shiite, Iraq is a Shiite majority country, as you see. And he knew that. He was trying to get the Shiites to overthrow Hussein. That was the whole point. And that's why Hussein attacked Iran and later went after the Shiites. Hussein was a Sunni. What Bush forgot to think about when he went into Iraq was that once you toppled Hussein, you had a Shiite majority and you're going to have a real problem. Iraq was fundamentally created over oil, was partitioned conveniently. In the north and sector, it was basically part of Kurdistan. So they copped off that part, like Poland. There was no Kurds. Kurds are like the Poles of the Middle East. Their country's been more chopped up than anything. They don't have a country, but they should. They even speak their own language. And then in the south, you have the Shiite and Sunnis. So today what's going on is a Shiite and Sunni war that essentially what's going on. Assad is actually, he's a Shiite. He's called Alawite, which is a Shiite. And it's a war between Shiite versus Sunni. The Hezbollah, which is Iranian Shiite, are helping Assad. So is Iran, Shiite. Now what's going to happen, and this is sort of like writing on the wall, is when Assad falls, next will be another major bloody civil war in Lebanon. There's no way getting around it. You have Hezbollah becoming weakened if Assad falls, being a Shiite, so the Hezbollah and the Shiite factions, including Nawmalik, fighting against, first time, get back again, against the Maronite Christians. But it's essentially the Hezbollah and the Shiite versus Sunni. But this time, the Maronite Christians and the Fulani will be all allied with the Sunnis. As they say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So it will be a major, major, major bloodbath. Now, Jordan. Those who know history have to realize Jordan is part of the Palestine Mandate. And I have here an interview that was carried out by a gentleman named Michael Koren, which he's pretty quite well known. And he had an interview with a very well known Jordanian Palestinian who is a well known and esteemed journalist and academic named Mudar Zaran. And I just want you to hear what he has to say. And it's quite important. Has to do with Jordan and what he says, what's really going on and what it is. You have to realize Jordan is basically Palestinians, Palestinian state, has a small minority of Bedouins who have always lived in that area. And it's ruled by the Hashemite family, which Hashemites are from Arabia. They were the sheikhs of the western side, part of Arabia, and they're also the lineage, or they say they're the lineage of Muhammad himself. That was what the Hashemites, and they were kicked out in the 1920s during a revolt that was backed by the British, allied with the Saudi family to kick out the Hashemites, and thus unified Arabia and took over Arabia, and da da da. It was all about oil. Bottom line. Anyway, I want you to listen to this interview, even though it's done by Michael Horn, not myself. I was going to try to write things down, but it's better for you to hear it for what it is. Here goes. It's going to be about 7 minutes.
A solution to the Israel-Palestine problem. Oh, that's easy. Really? Mudar Zaran is a Palestinian writer and academic from Jordan who now resides in the UK as a political refugee. He joins us now from London. Welcome to you, sir.
Hi, good sir. Thank you.
Now, a solution to this issue that seems to divide the world and causes so many problems. Give it to us, please. We're eager to hear.
Well, it's always been there. I mean, it's nothing new, sir. I mean, it's always been there. Jordan has always been the homeland for the Palestinians. This was the agreement. Very few people understand the history of the problem. Very few people understand that it was originally the Balfour Declaration that all of the British mandate of Palestine would become a Jewish homeland. Then the Jews decided to agree to give 78% of the land to the Palestinian or the Arab rulers of the country. And that's Jordan. Jordan has always been Palestine. The only thing that's not Palestinian in Jordan is the king. If that falls to the Arab Spring, voila, we have a Palestinian state.
But you know better than I do that even if the royal family did fall in Jordan and has many supporters, the Palestinian people would not be satisfied with Jordan. They would still want areas of Israel.
Well, the fundamentalists of us, you know, all nations have fundamentalists. And our fundamentalists, they've always wanted all of Palestine. And now they've grown into the last 15 years into wanting to build an subscribing to building an empire, a Muslim empire, a caliphate, if I may say. Mm. Now, we will not be held hostage to all of those. Now, let's just check the facts. Most of Palestinians reside in Jordan, more than 80% of the population.
Yeah.
1.1 million Palestinians are residing in Jordan illegally. If those were so desperate to be in Palestine, quote-unquote, shouldn't they be going back to Israel and living there? There's an average of 30,000 Palestinians relocated permanently to Jordan each and every year. So all of the signs do not suggest that the Palestinians are so desperate to be in Israel.
It sounds like, look, I've heard this many times over the years, but generally, I have to say, it does come from people who are strongly supporters of Israel, very Zionistic. To come from a Palestinian from Jordan, this is quite surprising to me. How are you regarded by other people in the Palestinian movement?
Well, you can always Google my name in Arabic and English. I mean, I'm very well accepted within the Palestinians. I have been on all Arab networks advocating Palestinians' rights in Jordan. People have had enough. People speak low. The propaganda that the king and his people have been put on is, oh, the Palestinians want to have all of Palestine back, or the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria back. This is not true, and the evidence is there that it's not the case. Most Palestinians have come to learn in 40 years that our problem is the Hashemites, not the Israelis. I'll give you one little example. In the last, the Jordanian government media, whether accomplice of the Jordanian government or not, I don't know, but the government-controlled Jordanian media called for a protest against the Israeli embassy a few months ago. And I went out on YouTube and other places telling people not to go. And eventually, the Washington Post reported less than 200 people showed up. I'm not going to be sitting here trying to advocate myself as a hero of the Palestinian. All I'm telling you is I am not an isolated case. Most Palestinians in Jordan, most Palestinians in the world have had enough now. And just one good example of how the Palestinian ideology has changed. One quick example is a poll that shows 70% of Palestinians in Jerusalem would rather for the Israeli rule of Jerusalem to stay. People are people. People would like to live normally, celebrate, and not suffer and be treated as subhumans by the king or anyone else. By the way, same goes for the Jordanian Bedouins. Mm. They are oppressed by the king, and they too have been speaking to me, telling me, we don't mind if the Palestinians rule as long as we live normally.
Well, let me push on that, because I know Jordan a little, and I know Palestinians who will say they've been treated better by Israelis at checkpoints than they are by Jordanian, by Bedouin. There's quite a bit of hostility. Palestinians may be a large number in Jordan, but they have little positions of influence, particularly within the military and intelligence services. But the real family has a tight control, and it is the family. The family have a tight control over that country.
Not anymore, sir. The media, Jordan now is a sideshow comparing to Syria, to Egypt, and other places. So it's very hard, very difficult to get CNN or anyone else, or even Al Jazeera, for that matter, to get in interested in what's going on in Jordan. Things have changed. The Bedouins in the south, just last week, some of them, my personal friends, the leaders of the Bedouin opposition, have been protesting against the king and calling for the king's, toppling the king through peaceful means. This is unprecedented. The king is fragile. The king is shaky. He's lost his grip. He's nowhere close to his father, either in charisma or in ideology or in knowledge of the region.
True.
The Jordanian regime is a sinking ship. It's no longer a Boeing 747. It's a glider. Very few people will believe that at the moment, but things will come to surface as quickly as the regime in Syria falls. The flu is going to catch up in Jordan very quickly, and then people will probably be thinking otherwise.
Just very briefly, if this did ever happen, would Saudi Arabia allow this? I mean, Saudi Arabia is a big power there, just next door to the south. Would they allow Jordan to become a Palestinian state?
Saudi Arabia, it's in its best interest to cooperate with whoever rules the largest bloc in the east, in the northern border, be it the Palestinians, the Hashemites, or aliens from Mars. They're going to take them. But until that happens, it's obvious that the Saudis are more on the conservative side. For example,
forgive me, I have to stop you there. We'll have you back. This is fascinating.
And so, as you heard, again, I'll repeat, you can look at him, Google him. There's plenty of YouTube interviews. He's written daily. He lives right now, actually, in the U.K., he has now put out a posting that he's been threatened continuously by the Jordanian kingship. So he's had serious threats. But do check him out. You spell his name as M-U-D-A-R. His last name is Zahran, Z-A-H-R-A-N. And I highly, highly, highly recommend that you listen to what he says, because actually he's telling the truth. I know from living in Israel myself, knowing Palestinians who lived even in the West Bank, they are people who just want to live their normal lives. They don't even like right now the Hamas. They don't like, obviously, Hamas. They do not like the Palestinian Authority. And they would more like, and they originally, by the way, they were Jordanian citizens when I lived there, would rather acclimate to that kind of situation. Either Jordan is recognized as the Palestinian state, or King Abdullah abdicates. Now, he is married to a Palestinian queen, and the future heir of Jordan will be a Palestinian or half Palestinian. So maybe the writing's on the wall. Maybe the writing is on the wall with Abbas becoming a Jordanian citizen, while many of the Palestinian Authority members are becoming Jordanian citizens as well, including Fayyad. They're all, the writing is there. Just watch that, you'll understand the real understanding of what's going on in Jordan. And as you watch in Syria, Syria is the key. As Assad goes down, things are going to erupt. It's going to affect Jordan and that area we spoke. And then there's the Shiite Sunni thing that's going to erupt in Lebanon, unfortunately. Now, regarding the Palestinians, that goes into a whole new, another picture. And I have to go back again, and I may be reiterating some things, but I have to go into the history of Amin al-Hussein. I'll read off some things, how he led into where he was, and how that led into Yasser Arafat, who he's the uncle of, and that led to, you know, what you have, the present conflict of the Palestinians. Amin al-Hussein was basically the pan-Arab violent, whatever, and he first formed a common root through his being the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He was basically appointed by the British, even against what the leaders of the Arabs living in the Palestine mandate. They were actually against it. He was directly involved with the Armenian genocide. He was an officer within the Ottoman Empire. He was actually an army officer, and he was one of the leaders who helped orchestrate the Armenian genocide during the 1914 and 1933. So he's very much involved with that. In fact, there's history facts of this. I'll give you an example. El-Hussein was born in Jerusalem under the Ottoman rule. Amin al-Husseini, he swore allegiance to the Ottoman Empire during the Armenian genocide. In fact, he was an officer stationed in Smyrna and participated firsthand in the Armenian genocide, where 1.5 million Christians were slaughtered under the sword of Islamic Jihad by the Ottoman Empire. His allegiance to the Ottoman Empire and Islamic world takeover will be well echoed by by bin Laden. And when he posted that, of course, in the 9/11 episode. So he was definitely a sociopath. But we have to continue on. It was in 1917 when the riots occurred in the 1920s. It all started when al-Hussein was appointed as leader of the Arabs in the Palestinian Mandate. He was appointed there by, and it was against their, you know, with the leaders of the Arabs at that time. Amin became the leader, which organized riots against locals, in fact. Amin becomes a lifelong campaign of inciting hate toward Jews and even Bosnians under the British Mandate. He begins his rule terror over local leaders at first, who denounce him as an ignorant thug. The British, though, against the local Muslim rule, against the local Palestinian Arab vote, appointed Ahmed al-Shir as a Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Ahmed Hossein came in a fourth place in the vote, in fact. He was fourth place, but still he was appointed. The Muslim community rejected his candidate because he had not even received any credible Islamic education. He was neither a sheikh, religiously accredited leader, nor an alim either. He became a permanent Arab power within the Palestine. His brutality becomes notorious and is often even rejected by local Muslim leadership. Amin Husseini is then appointed head of the Supreme Muslim Council. He's hugely disappointed by the end of the Ottoman Empire under Atatürk. Hussein becomes fanaticized by the idea that he must restore the lost Islamic empire. He vows to fight all Muslim seculars. Amin al-Hussein implements restoration of the Dome of the Rock and Al-Qasa in Jerusalem. He has a dome gold plated for the first time. So you know, those listening out there, nobody, the mosque in Jerusalem had no real significance. This is the first time they actually started restoring their own mosque. It was done in the 1920s by al-Husseini. So he has a dome plated for the first time. Thereafter, Jerusalem takes a major importance as a holy site in the eyes of the Arab world. It never did. Before 1920s, Jerusalem was never even considered as an important area. It is not important amongst Islam. Never was. It's not even one word in all the Quran says anything about Jerusalem, period. That's a fact. In fact, they even call Jerusalem in Arabic Al-Quds, and Al-Quds literally means the temple or Solomon's temple. Anyway, the Muslim Brotherhood established in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna in 1920. Al-Husseini becomes a central member and idol of inspiration for the Muslim Brotherhood, the mother organization for today's Egypt's Islamic Jihad and Hamas. The Muslim Brotherhood preaches a Wahhabi Islam, which I mentioned, which justifies violent means to rid the Muslim world of its non-Islamic element. It envisions a pan-Islamic empire, which embodies a strict Islamic law overall. In 1929, there was the infamous Hebron massacre. Amin al-Hussein organized more riots in the Palestine Mandate. He spreads false rumors and further turned the local Muslims against Jews. Random murdering of Hebron Jews began. Hebron Jewish community was once over 2,000 years old. In 1931, Elham starts to build his own political base. He preaches Islamic unity and creates the World Islamic Congress in 1931. In 1933, the Arab Nazi political spring up throughout. As I mentioned, there was the Young Egypt, which later was led by the Muslim Brotherhood Abdul Gamal Nasser, who then later, of course, we know about Mubarak and Sadat, and now today it is basically the Muslim Brotherhood. And there was the Soviet Socialist Party, aka the Ba'ath Party, which became Anton Zad. In 1936, there's François Guillaume, later known as a Swiss banker of Hitler's Third Reich, who travels to Palestine to meet al-Hussein for the first time. Their relation will continue into the 1960s. Ahmed al-Hussein is the main organizer of riots. He organized suicide squads against local authorities and applies Nazi mythology of systematic extermination of any Arab suspected less than total loyalty to the pan-Islamic vision of Muslim Brotherhood. Any non-Islamic element is a threat to his pan-Islamic vision. Many Muslim and Christian Palestinian intellectual leaders and clerics were assassinated for protesting against Husseini's terror. This occurred from 1936 all the way to 1938, murdered by Husseini's men. In fact, I'll read them off to you. They're Sheikh Du Hassan, Iman of Al-Qasa, Mas, the Sheikh Al-Nur El-Khatib, Sheikh Nasir Abdul Rahim, Council of the Muslim Religious Court, Sheikh Abdul El Madu of Acre, Palestine Mandate, Sheikh El Nomri of Hebron, Nasser El Adin Nasser, Mayor of Hebron, between 1937 and November 1938, 11 of Matar's community leaders and their entire family slain by Al Hussein's men. I mean, he went on a rampage. He killed off all those who, basically like a Nazi. Al Hussein even visited a German counselor in 1937 where he meets SS officer Eichmann and SS Obenschwer Hagen to discuss the Jewish question, or rather the final answer. Amin Hussein subsequently receives financial aid and military aid from Hitler. From 1941, Mufti joins Hitler in the jihad against Britain. El Hussein arrives in Rome where he meets fascist leader Benito Mussolini, who is committing the genocide and butcher of Ethiopians in Africa. Mussolini vows to help the Palestinians against the Jews. From Rome, Hussein declares fatwa or jihad against Britain. He preaches the notion of pan-Islamism with a vision of Muslim unity to further his cause. Of course, his roots even go on to our even present-day Iraq, which I'm not going to get into, but it spreads. He was also, of course, I mentioned he was involved with the Christian Syrian genocide, where 300,000 non-Muslims were put to death. Of course, the total was 200,000 Christian Serbs and 40,000 Gypsies and 22,000 Jews were killed by El Hussein, the Palestinian leader. And I already mentioned the other points. Now, he is the uncle of Yasser Arafat. A little background of Yasser Arafat, so you know how his link. And I'll get to... Yasser Arafat was very, very... This is pretty well different, I can say. Yasser Arafat was born in, actually, Egypt. He meets Al-Hussein at 17, starts to work for him. Amin al-Hussein allegedly, and now not allegedly, but is the great uncle of Arafat, whose real name, Arafat's real name, is Muhammad Abdur Rauf Arafat al-Qudwa al-Husseini. Arafat changed his name intentionally to disguise the name and his connection to al-Hussein. Yasser Arafat gets a Nazi education. Amin al-Hussein places Yasser Arafat in charge of arms procurement and shipment for the Mufti's irregular forces, the Holy Strugglers. Arafat becomes actively involved in terrorism against the Jewish settlers in the Palestine Mandate. In 1948, bad news for the believers, Israel is born. The United Nations General Assembly votes in favor of the partition into the Jewish state and of creating a Palestinian state, but of course it was rejected. So Israel declared its own independence the day which I'll get into, the British left. So we already know then, of course, Al-Hussein declares war, jihad against Israel, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and immediately declare war on the Jewish state. Of course, I'll explain that later, led by a British officer commanding the Arab Legion. Yasser Arafat was interviewed at Al Hashir in 2000. We are not Afghanistan. We are the mighty people. Were they able to replace our hero, Haj Amin Hussein? There were a number of attempts to get rid of Haj Amin when they considered him an ally of the Nazis. But even so, he lived in Cairo and participated in the 1948 war, and I was one of his troops. Yasser Arafat becomes a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He devotes his life to fulfilling vision of ridding Israel of Palestine of its Arab Jewish population. Of course, I can go on and on with him. He was then later appointed as a attaché in the Fight Ayin against Israel. And that occurred, of course, creating more terrorism. In fact, then he created the Fatah movement, was created in 1957 under aspects of Egypt. And it was originally formed by Yasser Arafat, Khalid Hassan, Farouk Hakami, and Khalid Al-Hawazi. Fatah is a prior military organization with the main goal of destroying the state of Israel and ridding Palestine of its Jewish population. In fact, it had a real quote, this means relentless terrorism, infiltration in Israel, relentless propaganda turned the local Palestinian people against the Jews. I mean, there were multiple. It's basically Yasser Arafat was embracing Hussein's dream, getting rid of all Jews from Palestine. In fact, they didn't call themselves Palestinian. There was nothing like that. They called themselves Muslims, Arab Muslims getting rid of Jews. They never considered themselves Palestinians. The idea of Palestinians started in 1964. Called the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was founded on the auspices of the Arab League. The PLO is a direct continuation under the Fatah movement, which was created by Nasser in the early 1950s. Its association is the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, I'm just telling you straight up what the history was. You know, people think he was so grandiose. I mean, even in 1969, Arafat tried to take over Jordan. That was the famous 19 battles in the called the September 1970 September, where he was literally pushed out. King Hussein declared a martial law against Arafat. And Arafat, there was, like I said, the major attacks, they were removed in 1971. Arafat fleeced Lebanon, and thus Lebanon was the new haven for Arafat and the PLO. And of course, there was the 1970, 75, 76, there were civil wars, and Arafat and his PLO destabilized Lebanon. It was peaceful at that time, but basically, the civil war broke out between the Lebanese government and the PLO. There are almost 44,000 people died between 1975 and 1976. 44,000 people died. You didn't see people protesting over that, huh? That was all because of Palestinians at the PLO. The PLO in 1976 was accepted as a member of the Arab League. In 1976 through 82, Arafat launches relentless terror attacks on Israel from the southern Lebanon. Arafat continues to implement el-Husseini's vision of murder the Jews. And this, of course, continued. And that's what you have today with the Palestinians. Palestinians, have you heard of the PLO, was basically an ideology to get rid of the Jews. I mean, Hamas calls for the slaughter of all Jews. That is exact decree in their charter. The same decree as in Hitler Germany. This is the same decree that's in the Muslim Brotherhood Charter. Get rid of all non-Muslim pure, it's like the pure Aryan race. This is what people don't want to hear about, but it's the truth. This is what people get all weird about when they're, oh, it's only a minority. It's a minority. Well, now they all that minority controls Egypt. That majority controls Gaza. That minority is influenced everywhere. That influences Al-Qaeda. That is their influence. And then the other spectrum, you have the Shiite who wants to control their caliph of all of them. That's from coming from Iran. And Carter himself really, in all actually, really hated Jews. You know, he's an idiot. The dumbass Carter thought, oh, well, can moderate Hamas. It begs the wonder of his own understandings. Who could defend somebody? Like, would anybody today defend Hitler? Why would you defend Hamas? I mean, I believe the real truth, Carter himself hates Jews and is very disgusting. I mean, he supported the Khmer Rouge, which it's genocide. He supported the Indonesians commit genocide in East Minor people. And he backed the Pinochet government in Chile, which slaughtered thousands. Now, here's a quick history of Israel. And I won't go too much into history because I don't know how much. But if you look into previous shows, I'll explain about the British and the oil and how it created a mandate. And, of course, the history of King Hejaz. Please look up the history of King Hejaz and you'll realize what I'm telling you. First, though, the partition of 181 in 1947 by the UN, which was a recommendation, not a resolution or recommendation, it was out of the General Assembly by the UN, was rejected by the Arab nations and leaders of Palestine, namely Al-Hussein. But when the Prince left the mandate on May 14, 1948, that's when Israel declared itself an independent nation. And of course, under the British commanding officer, John Bagot Club, who led the Arab armies and who was head of the Arab Legion to destroy the new state of Israel, they failed. A ceasefire was immediately implemented, and of course the armistice was set, and those are known as the 48 armistice boundaries prior to 1967. So when people say the 67 boundaries, they're really talking 48 boundaries. It's like retarded. You have to say pre-67. In 1956, of course, we all know Nasser took over Egypt, and of course they nationalized and took over the Suez, which was then controlled by the British and the French. And at the same time, they fought, Egypt and Israel fought after Israel was not allowed to go through the Suez with its ships, even though by national, international law, they were supposed to be allowed to. And of course, as Form mentioned, the Fedayeen attacks led by the Egyptian officer Yasser Arafat, founder of the PLO, against Israel continued on and on through via the Gaza Strip into areas in Israel. In 1967, again, Egypt closed the Straits of Tehran and pledged to wipe Israel. Israel preemptively attacked Egypt, but Jordan attacked and Syria attacked Israel. Israel won the Sinai from Egypt, of course, later on was returned. The Golan Heights from Syria was won. The West Bank and uniting Jerusalem was from the Jordanians. There was no such thing as Palestinians. Thus, it cannot be considered occupied territory. In 1970, there was a war of attrition by Egypt, nothing gained. In 1973, during the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur, Israel was simultaneously attacked by Egypt and Syria, orchestrated by the Soviet Union in an attempt to destroy Israel. Israel, of course, devastated both Egyptian and Syrian armies. The idea, within minutes, were away from Cairo and Damascus, with the Soviet army officers, lead officers who orchestrated both 67 and now 73, were trapped. A yellow alert was declared by Nixon due to the nukes being pointed out by the Soviet Union unless Israel withdraws or holds their advancing forces, which were within minutes from Cairo. Nixon immediately calls the Israelis to halt, fearing an imminent possible nuclear war starting. After 1973, Kissinger began the strategic lodging of Soviet influence of Egypt with Sadat, and this led, of course, to the eventual peace accord at Camp David. Carter had nothing to influence it, but he received the benefit of what was already in motion. In the 1980s, Israel was hit severely with rocket attempts, non-stop from the 70s on through the 80s at Israeli towns by the PLO, as mentioned before. Israel went in, fought. The Syrians were inside Lebanon at the time, protecting the PLO presence with their army. The Syrians, of course, got really handed to them. were what? The Syrian army was devastated and removed from Lebanon. The PLO was forced to leave, but Reagan requested Israelis move back to below Litani and allowed the PLO to leave. This allowed, of course, Syria to move back in with its army in the north, thus which allowed later on the Iranian militia, known as the Hezbollah. Now, of course, they bombed the U.S. Marines, killing hundreds of Marines in Beirut. And of course, what did Reagan do? Nothing. In fact, that's what changed many of what we already believe the Arab and Muslims now realize they weren't afraid of Americans, because before that, there were never American targets. Remember, before the bombing of the hundreds of Marines in Beirut, there were no terrorist attacks upon Americans. Europeans, yes, but they were really, really afraid of Americans. When they saw that Americans wouldn't do nothing, they got, as some would say, a lot of nerve. So the PLO was sent on its way to the Tunisia. Yet Bush Sr. forced Prime Minister then Shamir of Israel to the Madrid Conference, which ultimately led to the Oslo Accords. And what is the Oslo Accords? The Oslo Accords, which allowed the PLO to come to the areas known as Areas A and B in Gaza to form interim self-rule. Israel and the PLO would cooperate economically and develop with the guidance and help of the G7, namely the European states, including the United States. All final status questions, including final borders and statehood and security, would be done through negotiations only. Letters of mutual recognition were attached as part of the Oslo Accords. And here is Yasser Arafat's letter to Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister at that point. September 9th, 1993. Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister. Dear Mr. Prime Minister, the signing of the Declaration of Principle marks a new era. I'd like to confirm the following PLO commitments. The PLO recognizes the right of the State of Israel to exist in peace and security. The PLO accepts United Nations Council Resolution 242 and 338. The PLO commits itself to a peaceful resolution of the conflict between the two sides and declares that all its outstanding issues relating to permanent status will be resolved through negotiations. Get it? All outstanding related permanent status will be resolved through negotiating. Permanent status, statehood. That also included security, everything through negotiations. The PLO renounces the use of terrorism and other acts of violence and will assume responsibility of all PLO elements and personnel in order to assure their compliance and prevent violations and discipline violators. Did they? No, they didn't. The PLO affirms that those articles of the Palestinian Covenant which deny Israel right to exist will be removed. The provisions of the Covenant which are inconsistent with the comments of this letter are now operative and no longer valid. Consequently, the PLO undertakes and submits to the Palestinian National Government for a formal approval of the necessary changes in regard to the Palestinian Covenant. Sincerely, Chairman Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian Liberation Army. Also does not mention anything about settlements. So when Abbas talks about settlements and not having negotiation, it's pure bullshit. They were to have negotiations finished. Nothing else. Everything through negotiations. The settlements were never, ever an issue. Nobody talked of who was getting what at that time. But this, besides violating the order from the very get-go through all the terrorist activity, on November 29, 2012, the PA, the PLO, violated its own agreement, also the UN, by accepting and upgrading a state of Palestine with borders is a violation of its own charter. The UN cannot allocate borders between countries. Again, the UN cannot allocate borders between countries, only can recommend. The UN violated its own charter by its own violation in its prior recognition of all treaties between nations. You can look it up. It's quite clear. Due to the violation by the PA and what is Israel to do? Well, it is going to redistribute all monies to pay off the PA's creditors, bills as it fits. The U.S., what will it do? It will probably have a right to cease all funding to the PA. Under U.S. law, it is now under their jurisdiction, under United States law, to cease funding to all UN, any UN to upgrade, and it's a fact, you upgrade any UN elements of any status by the PA or Palestinians to any kind of state upgrade is a violation and therefore will be rescinded of any funds. So don't blame the U.S. for defunding the UN. UN did it themselves. Now last, what can Israel do? Well, there is the obvious that I had mentioned, the Jordan option. It is what was mentioned by my what I had mentioned in that prior interview by Mudar Saran, who said Jordan is the answer nobody wants to talk about. It is the Jordanian option. Maybe perhaps go to Alompan, which gives Jordan the eastern area of the West Bank, but remains demilitarized. Or perhaps maybe a joint control of the West Bank, whatever. And maybe the Palestinians get their Jordanian ship back in the West Bank. And the Gaza, well, that just goes back to Egypt and is done. Done. And then all Palestinians have to do, all the remaining countries, respective countries they live in, they're absorbed. And then both Jews and Arabs that were dislocated from the regions, from their homes, are reimbursed. Done. Done. So simple. So easy. So, I want to thank you all for listening once again. I know that was a plethora of information regarding the Middle East. If you have any questions or thoughts, feel free to contact me. I'm right now realigning new interviews. I'm constantly being bombarded of people wanting to come on the show, but I'm very highly selective. Actually, I'm trying to get a couple of very selective people to come on my show, but we had to move them off from December to next year due to times and holidays and stuff. We were going to have them this. It was all planned. Hopefully, I will have a special guest for the 21st. I will mention that. If not, I will give a special dissertation of the 21st. That will be a special, very, very special show. So do listen. And next week, I will have another special show, which I'll get into other dynamics. More specifically, the freedom of speech, so people understand what that means. Again, I want to thank you. And as Chamber Brothers would say, the time has come for today. And with that, I want to thank you all for listening in. God bless you all and have a glorious weekend. And with my words, we are one, one universe, one consciousness. We are all connected to one another, connected to God, to the universe. God bless you all and have a glorious weekend. And with that, I will go with the Chamberlain Brothers. Time has come today. Come on! God bless you all. Bye.